Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with First Things editor Rusty Reno about the sexual abuse revelations and allegations that have kept Americans busy all fall and culminated so far in the Roy Moore debacle. What is the relation of personal character to public office? Are the Pence rules finally in style? Where should we draw the line between sex fiends and unmannerly men? What's with that cat person story? And what is with Lena Dunham? Then I'll examine the uses of nostalgia in the canon of great American Christmas songs. I'm senior editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. As of this recording, here are some recent highlights from the rolling story of sexual abuse and harassment allegations against powerful and not so powerful American men. Republican senatorial candidate Roy Moore has lost the special election in Alabama to a pro-abortion Democrat. Allegations that Moore had pursued teenage girls sexually while in his 30s were doubtless influential in his defeat. Celebrity chef Mario Batali has stepped away from his restaurant empire, conceding the truth of allegations of extensive sexual misconduct. Restaurateur Ken Friedman has stepped away from his restaurant empire for similar reasons. The New Yorker has fired political reporter Ryan Lizza, without exactly spelling out why. Lizza denies any wrongdoing and calls his firing a terrible mistake. The New Yorker has published a short story titled Cat Person, which has gone viral as part of the Me Too moment, and started a conversation about what qualifies as consent. The other day, I realized with a start how totally sex has displaced race as the stuff of our national nightmares. The summer of Richard Spencer turned to the fall of Harvey Weinstein. What will winter bring? I'm joined by Rusty Reno. Rusty, let's start with Roy Moore, though not dwell on him, since his case got a lot less interesting when he lost. But it's still an occasion for us to ask, how should we think about personal character in relation to public office?
It's obviously important because we have to have politicians who are trustworthy in their custodianship of the public good. But I would distinguish between two kinds of corruption. There's personal corruption, and it would seem as though the accusations against Moore dramatize that kind of corruption. But there's also political corruption, and political corruption is a corruption where a politician uses public office to promote his own private good or the private good of those who support him. So it's a commandeering of the public good for private purposes, and that distinction is important, and it helps us understand why a certain kind of liberal will acknowledge that John F. Kennedy was a corrupt man in a significant moral way, but that corruption was personal or bore upon his personal life and not upon his public role. And that if they're fans of JFK, they think that he honorably discharged his duty as a custodian of the public good.
They say the same thing about Clinton, right?
Same. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. There's kind of an interesting, very partial revisiting of that lately. You know, you have Kristen Gillibrand saying, "Oh, yeah, he should have resigned." Rather 20 years too late, but oh well.
Right. Well, I think most people intuitively sense this distinction. They would like to have the total package. You'd like to have somebody who's unbesmirched in any respect. But people just recognize that there are some vices that bear directly upon the discharge of public office, and there are other vices that, while regrettable, so a person could be an alcoholic, for instance, and that would compromise, perhaps, their performance in public office, but it wouldn't directly threaten the public good. But in this matter of sexual abuse, the reason why it's, I think, become so prominent is because there is a sense in which, you know, this question about sexual the equality of men and women and the ability of women to flourish in professional life is a matter of political-public concern. And so this kind of exploitation of power and position to impose oneself upon women in the boorish way that Al Franken did, or to even compel or coerce women, as apparently Harvey Weinstein might have done, does strike many as being having a public significance, not just a private significance. When people look back on Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, the typical American in our time does not say, "Oh, the great threat here to the public good is that he was an adulterer." Instead, he abused his power vis-a-vis an employee who was of much lower status. And so people transform his peccadillo, you see, into a public political question rather than a strictly moral question. And the fact that people do that is an indication of the fact, I think, that they do intuitively sense the difference between, if you will, private vice and public vice.
Yeah, I do remember, though, in the 90s when liberal defenders of Clinton were working very hard to push back in the other direction and say, no, there's no public dimension to this. It's purely private. And if you don't approve of it, then you're one of those evil, repressive Puritans. I mean, there was this kind of polemic against voyeuristic Puritanism that was designed to kind of launder Clinton and make his critics morally suspect.
And Europeans are more, I think, make a sharper distinction between public vice and private vice. And so, you know, the parliamentarians in parliament members in England who were using public funds to have their houses remodeled justly evoke the ire of the British public, in contrast to was undoubtedly, you know, the parliament's very large, it's got about 600 members. There's undoubtedly many members of parliament who have very sordid private lives. And I think most voters would rather not know about that. And if they did know, might wring their hands and find it regrettable and even disgusting, but nevertheless go ahead and vote for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to that point, it seems that these revelations about private character or private wrongdoing are even more important in the eyes of our elites than they are in the eyes of voters or media consumers. You know, so Republican Party bosses were immediately very happy to cut Roy Moore loose when these allegations surfaced. It was less clear that rank-and-file voters were going to do that. On the Democratic side, John Conyers, Al Franken, have been pushed out by their party elites, whereas probably both of them would have been reelected. And media men have been falling very fast and very hard, and that's a case in which regular folks literally and figuratively don't get a vote. So what do you think is going on with that?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that our elite culture is very eager to construct a gender-neutral society. And this pattern of male exploitation of their strength, power, and privilege bears directly on, it threatens that project. So I think that's a fairly straightforward reason why it's a matter of preoccupation for our leadership class. That's what leadership classes are supposed to do. They're supposed to set the tone for society. And we live in the gender-neutral goal is overriding in our elite culture. By contrast, it's not a goal of our elite culture to promote chastity, for instance. And that's why I think if Matt Lauer had an adulterous consensual affair with countless women, it would not have compromised his position, because adultery is not a threat to the political project of our leadership class. And so I think that's what's driving this. We have a project, it's a project of having a gender-neutral society. And I think all of these defenestrations of men turn on the threat that their peccadillo has posed to that project. And so I think it's particularly somebody like Al Franken. I mean, his behavior, I think, would fall under the boorish category rather than anything
coercive
or criminal. Right? Nobody wants to get their butt pinched,
right,
or have some drunk man force himself on you and forcing you to slap him in the face. There's many, many reasons to criticize him for that. But why was that tolerated, you know, 30 years ago and not now? Well, first of all, 30 years ago wasn't tolerated because a man who acted in that boorish way around women was censured as being not acting like a gentleman. So that fell by the wayside. But still, I don't think that this boorish behavior would rise to such levels of political significance were it not for this goal of a gender-neutral society. And also the anxieties that so many feel, men and women, that it's a utopian goal that is going to be very, very difficult to achieve. Therefore, we have to double down, really put effort into punishing those who are standing in the way of that goal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I see in a few of these cases a keener, even more hysterical anxiety about men's promiscuity per se, and whether the encounters associated with that are ever, in a proper sense, consensual. Masha Gessen has written about this a bit for The New Yorker.
No, I think that, so if we want a gender-neutral society where men and women mix freely without any differences, then one of the big threats to that is that the male sexual personality is not the same as the female
yeah.
sexual personality.
Yeah.
And so I think you'll see with our leadership class a repudiation of that difference.
Yeah.
So it's just not, I mean, people just insist it's not the case that there is this difference, and that therefore it's unjust to organize society in such a way as to acknowledge and defend against the implications of that difference. So, I mean, a traditional society, then, it has mores for female behavior and mores for male behavior that are different. And those mores are not just designed, as many women theorists think, to defend patriarchy, but those mores are also designed to defend women. It's possible that they could, in fact, do both.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's it seems to me, the kind of crisis that the atmosphere of crisis that we see around all these allegations is the fear that the male-female difference will come roaring back and we'll be forced to reckon with it in our public culture. So like someone like Mike Pence.
Right. So, yeah, let's talk about the Pence rule.
Well, the Pence rule is clearly, it's clearly organized in a kind of neo-traditional pattern
mm-hmm.
to try to evoke a separation of the male and female and a careful guarding of their intimate interactions. That it's like having, it's like the old days when at colleges you had, you could only meet with the girl under the supervision of the dorm mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was some very proper girls' colleges had very rigorous rules about being supervised in the male-female interaction. And that's basically what Pence does.
Right. So let me just recap.
And then he gets hammered.
Yeah.
For having this approach that puts women at a disadvantage in the workplace.
Right. So let me just recap for our listeners who may not remember back to last spring. It was revealed that Vice President Mike Pence has these rules where he never dines or drinks with women who are not his wife, including women he knows professionally unless his wife is present, never attends parties or functions where alcohol is served unless his wife is present, the idea being that a spousal chaperone, just like a dorm mom,
mm-hmm.
can help you avoid or resist temptation in situations that otherwise would be morally dangerous. And then there's this huge backlash, all these think pieces saying that this is terribly sexist and Pence is disadvantaging women professionally. If he were just a good man, he wouldn't need to be on his guard against women.
Right. Well, I think it's, as James Madison said, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. So, yes, if human beings were not fallen, we would not need moral rules to protect us against temptation.
Right. So flash forward to November, the New York Times suspended their star political reporter, Glenn Thrush, for what? Getting drunk in the company of female colleagues and peers in his profession.
And then in his drunken state saying stupid,
unmannerly
boorish things.
Exactly. actually, nothing criminal at all. Arguably, nothing even particularly wrong, except that he was being unfaithful to his wife. But if he had followed Pence's rules, he would not have been unfaithful to his wife, and he would have kept his job. So second look at the Pence rules?
No, not really.
No.
Instead, what our ruling class wants is a certain kind of, this is a kind of Puritanism. I mean, so when I'm just old enough to have left college before we had co-ed bathrooms, but I'm supposed to be able to be 18 years old and go into a bathroom and see the girl coming out of the shower with her towel around her. And I'm supposed to be able to contain myself in every respect. So we're all supposed to be kind of moral athletes in a way.
Yeah,
perfectly
it's this kind
trained.
Of mystical antinomian chivalry, where without ever having been trained, you just naturally are
well,
a gentleman always.
But of course you are trained. And the end result is, I think, kind of desexualization, especially of men. And now women are upset, or at least young women find themselves dissatisfied with these kind of man children who want to play video games. And you think, well, you know, if you're an upper middle class boy, you have to be trained and you have to in some way be sufficiently neutered that you can function in this unisex world without falling afoul with the consequences of your own instincts and wind up like the New York Times reporter. So this is what happens with all utopian projects. When the communists tried to get rid of private property, they had to take very draconian methods to drive that natural human impulse out. And of course, it always kept seeping back in, and you need various purges and, you know, renewals of commitment and all that kind of stuff in order to keep the pure vision alive. So we're in one of those phases.
Yeah, it's worth saying that though the Pence rules are not gaining legitimacy among our commentating class, I think there is a desire to generate new regulations and limitations. So after that long season of polemics against rules pertaining to sex, we see...
Yes has to be yes.
Yeah, so standards of affirmative consent,
yes.
Or enthusiastic consent,
right.
That's a new one. Certain near occasions of sin being prohibited or limited by employers. So Vox is a good example of this. Vox is limiting the amount of alcohol its staffers can imbibe at their Christmas party. So they're going to make sure that more hors d'oeuvres are passed around so no one is drinking on an empty stomach. And instead of an open bar, they'll have two drink vouchers for every staffer. They're obviously trying to avoid the Glenn Thrushing of their staffers. But this comes after Vox had hammered Mike Pence saying, and I quote, good character is better than strict rules. I would say that Pence's self-imposed rule is evidence of his good character, whereas
right.
This Vox rule is just a rule designed to limit their legal liability.
It's Cass Sunstein. They're trying to nudge their employees rather than actually, and that's
right.
Kind of the direction that we see our antinomian, it's because it's of course not really antinomian, it's got these very rigid and strict rules as we see on the part of the decapitation of these baby boomer men who thought the rules were still the 1970s rules. Mm-hmm. And the 1970s was the worst of the 60s. It was hedonism without any idealism. And so, and we're long past that. And as you pointed out, we have you know, firms like Vox that are trying to nudge people towards sobriety at their Christmas party. And I mean, what should conservatives be saying about this? I think we should be seeing it for what it is. It's a kind of pale imitation of traditional morality, a kind of ersatz morality of restraint. And that's not a bad thing.
It's not bad, but it only takes you so...
It's not the real thing.
It's not the real thing. And so this takes me to my next question. is what we're seeing now. Is this a very opportune moment for Christians who want to preach Orthodox sexuality? Are folks who never were receptive to our message before going to be receptive now?
No, that's a great question, and it's hard to know. People know something's wrong in a way that was not true when I was in my 20s. The dream really was we could be in a kind of post-repressive world. We could have a healthy affirmative attitude towards sex, and once people affirm that healthy attitude, things would sort of naturally fall into positive, healthy relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And it just hasn't worked out that way. And so I think this is just a general symptom and of people's dissatisfaction, especially women's dissatisfaction with the sexual culture of our time. But I think we need to take a step back and realize one of the consequences of the fall is that sex will always be problematic. And so there is no real solution to this.
I think that progressives are so utopian about sex that they're never going to admit that.
That's true.
You know? So that seems like a really intractable problem.
Yes.
I mean, from a social conservative's point of view, it's been interesting to see, you know, some internal contradictions of the sexual revolution have become manifest,
yeah.
Flagrant even. So a classic one, and this is just an old conservative talking point, turns out the normalization of non-marital sex and the general loosening of norms is a better deal for men than for women.
Right.
You don't say.
Right.
But, I mean, they get it now. But the response has tended to be, okay, so we need a yet more thoughtful version of the sexual revolution. And one of the most significant motifs of this has been we need a really sensitive deployment of consent as still the sole criterion for ethical conduct. I think we've already put way too much pressure on that concept. And with this new parsing, you know, when is consent truly consensual? When is it consensual enough? We just see the cracks showing. So here's a recent artifact. This short story in The New Yorker titled Cat Person. Did you see this?
I haven't read it, but I've had it detailed to me.
Exactly. So in this story, a young woman has a sexual encounter that is technically consensual, as they say, but she feels implicitly coerced into it by her own politeness or even by pity for the guy. So she has bad sex with a near stranger and comes to regret it as the worst life decision she's ever made. And the conversation about this story online is largely about the nature of consent. So for example, there's this tweet quoted in The Atlantic, "We need to create a culture of enthusiastic consent. We need to talk about all the nuances of consent in order to fix our broken culture." So Rusty, what do you think? Is that going to fix our broken culture?
I agree with you completely. It just can't bear the weight. Sex is very complicated, fraught, and consent can't possibly bear the weight of the full reality of this. I mean, that story, which you summarized and which a friend of mine talked to me extensively about, is obviously a story about the fact that men and women are different. You know, there have been no men coming forward to accuse powerful women of sexual exploitation of them. Why is that? Is it because powerful women don't bed down the handsome 25-year-old interns? No, undoubtedly they do. Men experience sexual exploitation differently than women. And nor are there any gay men who are coming forward from fashion
firms. One exception, right? Kevin Spacey.
Right.
Has been accused of.
Well, we get people underage. So I look at that Catwoman story, and it's about the difference between how that a 20-year-old female experiences casual sex differently than a 20-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that 20-year-old men aren't emotionally damaged by these kinds of things, but they're damaged by the mindlessness, probably, more than they're damaged by this kind of emotional hurt that's felt fairly quickly
mm-hmm.
by women in some instances. And so I find it fascinating that the whole chain of conversation just won't address that. And we're back to my point, which is that the social goal of our time is a genderless society. And so any admission that men and women are different at a deep level in how they desire, what they desire, how they experience sex is a real threat to that utopian vision.
Yeah, you're right that it's kind of in a way that just has not been talked about. It is kind of baked into this whole series of controversies and revelations, right? Because I kept thinking about Lauren Stein at the Paris Review, and you know, one of the scandalous revelations was that he would do quid pro quos, right? You know, a young woman writer or editor, you know, could get something from him professionally if she gave him something sexually. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, okay, this is very close to being industry standard in the literary business. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but
it happens
way more between men than it does between men and women.
Right.
Is my sense. And yet that is so far nowhere in any of these controversies or revelations. It's always about powerful men and less powerful women, not about powerful men and less powerful young men. Mm-hmm. That's been very conspicuous to me.
It's a different, I mean, it just testifies to the emotional difference that is just a reality that has to be grappled with and thought about. And traditional societies always are organized around that difference. Sometimes they're organized around that difference that are at the expense of women. Other times they're organized around that difference for the protection of women. And we have this genderless vision that it's going to break on the rocks of the reality of this male-female difference. But when it will break on the rocks, who knows? What will come after, I have no idea. But it won't work. And women are the ones who are going to have to decide that we need to kind of revisit the male-female difference. So my view is that this whole moment of decapitation and execution will end when women who are friends of, or husband, or wives of, or mothers of some of the men who get executed professionally start to say, wait a minute, he's not perfect, but come on. You know, he's not a bad guy, fair enough, he's a guy, mm-hmm. but he's not a bad guy.
Yeah.
Fair enough, he should have behaved better, but are we really going to take the kind of weakness that men are susceptible to, which is the high thumos male impulse, which definitely needs to be disciplined and punished when it acts criminally. What are we going to do about that?
Right.
I think is a question that women are going to have to make up their minds about.
Yeah, it seems to me that this has begun to happen in the context of campus sexual assault cases, right? Mothers of young men who've been expelled and had their academic careers ended over this have started to join forces and sort of make the argument that this isn't altogether just.
Well, didn't some of the women on the staff at Saturday Night Live that work for Al Franken, effectively go public with saying that, hey, he's not a bad guy.
Right.
So
I mean, it's certainly worth saying
you don't have to defend boorish behavior.
No.
Or you don't even have to. You don't have to defend criminal behavior, certainly, but you don't have to defend boorish behavior in order to make a case that sort of a certain neo-Puritan or this unrealistic ethos that's abroad right now needs to be moderated.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, so there are certainly men who have been bad guys, have been basically Bond villains even. I mean, one of the most hilarious but very bad, was the revelation that Matt Lauer had a secret button under his desk that he could push to lock the door of his office when he had a woman in there with him, which is just bananas. So there's that. But then there's someone like, I keep coming back to Glenn Thrush. Let me just read what he's accused of.
Okay.
And let's see whether we think these are firing offenses. One, at a bar once with a female Politico editor, he touched her leg and tried to kiss her. Two, leaving a Politico party with a female reporter, he kissed her and tried to hold her hand. Three, leaving another Politico party, he went home with a female reporter who then decided not to sleep with him, and he accepted that decision and peaceably departed. Four, a woman claims that he kissed her ear. That's it. And for this, not only is he in danger of losing his job, I mean, he's been humiliated nationally. Is this just?
No, obviously. Like I say, it's not, part of the difficulty of navigating through life is dealing with the imperfections of our fellow humans. And women, sadly for them, one of the imperfections they have to deal with is sort of the drunken male libido. And almost every woman has had to deal with that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's one of the things. There's the drunken male thumos at a bar. When I was younger, and it didn't happen very often, but on occasion, you guys want to fight you, and I think, oh my god, it's like, how do I get out of this situation? And it's similar to a woman being cornered by a guy in a bar who wants to kiss her, mm-hmm. and you know. Now, if the guy throws a punch at me,
he should be arrested.
He should be arrested, right. And if the guy can't be,
pushed away,
then he needs to bear the consequences. But that these things happen, you got to get rid of human beings in order to get rid of these situations.
The phrase that keeps coming up that I find troubling is unwanted advances. All these men are guilty of unwanted advances.
Yeah, you go to the New York subway, a lot of life in New York is unwanted advances on my personal space. They're not sexual advances, and that makes it different because sex is charged with all kinds of dangerous energy. And that electricity, we all sense the fact that electricity is dangerous. Just like violence is dangerous. And so we appropriately hem it in, and we appropriately have all kinds of mores to try to protect us, especially women, from that electricity. And then we have laws, obviously, also appropriately to punish people who egregiously transgress those boundaries.
Now, the absolute low point this fall, for my money, has been when a former writer for HBO's Girls was accused of rape, and Lena Dunham and her co-showrunner released a statement doubting the accusation. Now, I was inclined to look very kindly on that action. I believe that if your friend is accused of wrongdoing and you genuinely believe that he is innocent, you should stick by him, whatever the howling mob may say. Then I read the statement, quote, "While our first instinct is to listen to every woman's story, our insider knowledge of this situation makes us confident that sadly this accusation is one of the 3% of assault cases that are misreported every year," unquote. This is unbelievably smug. This seems an expression not of loyalty so much as superiority. I have insider information and big data. And then I was reminded that Lena Dunham herself has lodged a false accusation of rape. In her memoir, she says that she was raped by a guy named Barry, who just happened to be the one conservative student at Oberlin. Well, Barry is a real person who denies any wrongdoing. And I think it's been pretty well established that he's telling the truth. In the chapter of her memoir in which she relates this supposed incident, Lena Dunham writes, "I'm an unreliable narrator." Well, thank you, Humbert Humbert. good thing nobody's reputation was on the line.
Well, we can...
I once again have no time on my watch for Lena Dunham.
Yeah, well, right. Nobody's looking to Lena Dunham for any moral wisdom, that's for sure.
Oh, sadly, some people are.
Well, nobody with a half a brain is looking to Lena Dunham for moral wisdom.
Alas, high bar to clear.
My favorite Christmas movie when I was a child was White Christmas, the 1954 Technicolor film starring Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye as old army buddies and song and dance men who bring their act to Vermont one Christmas Eve to save the inn and the ego of their former general, whom they love. Now that I'm grown, I'm aware that White Christmas is disparaged by critics, but it remains powerfully nostalgic for me, especially when I watched the version I taped on VHS from cable circa 1991 with all the commercials, just like the ones I used to know. This year I watched Holiday Inn for the first time. Holiday Inn is the more highly regarded 1942 black and white film, of which White Christmas is a very loose remake. I found that Holiday Inn is indeed the superior film in many respects. I'll take Fred Astaire over Danny Kaye 8 days a week. But I became most interested in the way in which White Christmas is a remake, a revisitation, a nostalgia project, not just accidentally for me, but in conception. It's trying to recreate something from the past that was good. And of course, the song White Christmas, which debuted in Holiday Inn and bookends the later film, is extremely nostalgic. It dreams of a Currier and Ives Christmas, just like the ones we used to know. Irving Berlin, who wrote the song, nailed the backward-looking melancholy that we all seem to feel is part of Christmas. We've all had blue Christmases, but don't normally blazon as of the emotional essence of the holiday. On an especially sad note, Berlin's three-week-old son died on Christmas Day in 1928. Every Christmas, he and his wife visited the grave, and that's how they marked the Nativity of Christ. So there's something resonant in this connection of Christmas with things we used to know, which the song capitalized on big time. Crosby's early recording of White Christmas became the best-selling pop single of all time and held that title for over 50 years. Its popularity was helped by its inclusion in the Armed Forces radio playlist during World War II. When Crosby went on USO tours in the European theater, the song most requested by the troops, by far, was White Christmas. It made them think not just of Christmas's past, but of home and America. Crosby revisits that experience in the early scenes of the film White Christmas. At that point in the film, he's an army captain and amateur vaudevillian, singing to his fellow soldiers on Christmas Eve in France. So the song here expresses wartime nostalgia for the pre-war years. At the end of the film, he sings the same song to the same soldiers as they're reunited on Christmas Eve in Vermont in the 1950s. The song comes after a couple other numbers, including one titled, Gee, I Wish I Were Back in the Army. So here the song expresses post-war nostalgia for the war years. It's interesting how adaptable the song's nostalgia is, yet how precise it feels in every application. Crucial to its adaptability is the fact that this song is totally secular. No Christ child, no manger, no Mary, no Joseph, no angels, no shepherds, no star. You've only got snow, children, treetops, Christmas cards, that's it. All the great American Christmas songs are secular like this. Christians can complain about it, the evacuation of religious iconography and meaning from the great popular expressions of one of our great religious holidays. But it's worth observing that most of these songs were written in the early 20th century by Jewish songwriters, many of them immigrants who'd grown up on the Lower East Side. White Christmas was written by Berlin, who had fled Imperial Russia with his parents. Silver Bells, The Christmas Song, Holly Jolly Christmas, Winter Wonderland, It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year, and I'll Be Home for Christmas were all written by Jewish songwriters. And Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is almost painfully about ethnic difference and assimilation once you learn that the words were written by a Jewish ad man, Robert May, who concealed his Jewishness even from his second wife. Though to be honest, I've never found a solid source for that part of May's bio. I'm a little suspicious of it since it's so on the nose, as it were. Whatever, it works. It's become popular to observe that these secular carols were vehicles of assimilation. Clearly, these early 20th century Jewish songwriters regarded America as a country that celebrates Christmas. In White Christmas, which is a song of yearning, Berlin's looking back on an American Christmas is also an outsider's looking in on an American Christmas. These songs were a way to celebrate Christmas, which was a way of being American. Obviously, these men were working with a relation between the categories Christian and American that was complicated, as it remains today for somewhat different reasons. These are some of the realities that our magazine is dedicated to thinking through. One of our Christmas wishes here at First Things is to make America a country that celebrates Christmas again. Our civic and religious pieties should be compatible enough to be confused with each other and compelling enough to earn tribute from those who don't participate in them fully. Now, it is indeed the most wonderful time of the year, the First Things fundraising drive. If you want to make my days merry and bright, donate to our campaign at firstthings.com/donate. And while you're at it, navigate to firstthings.com/subscribe. Subscriptions start at only $19.95. Start the new year off right. I'll have a blue, blue Christmas if you don't. That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleague, Rusty Reno. And thank you, listeners, for donating generously and subscribing loyally. Merry Christmas. We'll be back in the new year.